Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, I have two great guests lined up for you today. My second guest shares an incredible story, one of those stories where you think, oh, that can't possibly be true, but it actually is. The author of 438 Days joins me from Chile to share the story of Captain Salvador Alvarenga. Outside Magazine calls 438 Days the best survival book in a decade. And my guest, Jonathan Franklin, will join us in the second half of today's show. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Matt Kaplan. When he's not chained to a desk in England, he's exploring the world for cherished myths and legends and love potions and all good stuff like that. And the result is a fascinating new book. I really enjoyed reading this. It's called Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. Matt Kaplan is a science journalist, author, adventure seeker, and recipient of a Knight Science Journalism Fellowship. He's a science correspondent at The Economist, where he's contributed weekly articles to its science and technology section for a decade. And he's also contributed to New York Times, National Geographic, New Scientist, and Nature. And again, the name of his new book is called Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. Matt Kaplan, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
Well, you're not chained to your desk in England right now, right? They let you out for a little while.
Yeah, they did. I've got just a couple more weeks of book tour, and then I'm back in the UK again, slaving away. Although they don't really let me free. I've got an awful lot of work to do out here too.
I'm sure.
You know, it's awfully nice. I'm currently in California, and boy, the weather's awfully sunny.
Well, it's not up here, so enjoy it down there. In fact, I can't even see hardly out the window. It's just everything is grey today, but never mind. So this is a really fascinating book because you're a trained paleontologist. You are a scientist, a scientific journalist by profession. So how did you become so engrossed in myth that you wanted to write a whole book about it?
Well, you look at a lot of the material that's out there, because there's plenty of books and plenty of articles that look at, was there a scientific underpinning to this? Was there a scientific underpinning to that? So, I mean, we've all seen stuff on the Discovery Channel or History Channel or in magazines saying, the 10 plagues, maybe there was some science. Maybe there was a volcanic eruption that caused a suite of things to occur that caused our ancestors to completely freak out and come up with myths to explain what they were seeing. And a lot of this is scattered, and a lot of it is bad. And there's no one out there who has tackled the issue of mythology and science and done it from a neutral perspective, being willing to say, no, I don't think this is true. And moreover, I haven't found anyone who has gone out there and really given our ancestors a lot of the respect that they deserve. It's so easy in today's day and age to look back and say, oh, those folks were chopping open goats, looking at their livers to try to predict the future. They were insane. and then just ended at that.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and as a paleontologist, when I first started delving into this stuff, you do read the Roman reports where they said Uncle Petronius was ill. We went to the hepatomancer, that's a liver reader. We had the hepatomancer kill our favorite goat, look at its liver, and he said it did not bode well for Uncle Petronius. And he was dead a month later, and so therefore the hepatomancer was right. And you think, are you out of your minds? What's wrong with you? How could you possibly believe that? And so you find a lot of literature that just dismisses this sort of stuff straight out. And I wanted to give it more time than that. I wanted to explore all of the angles. And with Libres in particular, it gets really interesting because you go back to people like Democritus, who's often pegged as one of the earliest scientists in ancient Greece. And in 400 BC, he was already writing, you know, and I'll actually quote it, I won't paraphrase, that he says that the ancients had widely established that the color and texture of livers was sometimes prophetic of health and sickness and sterility of the fields. So he was saying the ancients, now that's funny because he's 400 BC, so he's talking about people way before him. He's talking about people like the Assyrians who lived in 2000 BC and started all of this liver nonsense. He's saying, you know what? I think they may have been using this liver reading to predict whether or not their fields were going to be good. And that raises all kinds of questions, because when you look at, people wrote down very early what they thought a good liver was. They would say it was bright in color, firm, it had a soft, smooth texture. If it was rough or yellow or limp, these were all bad signs. And, you know, with regards to Uncle Petronius's health, that's insane. How can you possibly care about what a goat's liver is going to say about Uncle Petronius and whether he'll survive the month? But when you go to the very beginning, people were going and killing a goat in a field where they were thinking about building a farm. And they would then examine that liver and question whether or not the gods were smiling upon the land.
Mm.
And so I called up Derek Collins, who's a classicist at the University of Michigan, and he's really there's not many experts today on liver readings. That's a kind of niche field.
Well, you actually went to read some livers yourself, to look at livers yourself, right?
I did. I went and did it because I called this classicist and I said, have you ever thought that maybe you could look at a liver and predict whether or not that there had been a drought in a field during the past 5 years? And he said, what do I look like, a veterinary pathologist? No, I have no idea. It's a nice idea, but I don't know. So being a science journalist, I started calling up veterinary pathologists and asking them, hey, could you look at a liver and determine whether or not the goat had suffered from pestilence during the past 5 years, or if the goat had suffered from starvation? And all the pathologists I spoke to said, oh yeah, definitely. Livers are like tree rings. The liver collects information about the life of the animal, and when the animal dies, you can look at the liver and see what kind of a life it was exposed to.
Right.
And I said, well, wait a minute, you're a veterinary pathologist. Could an idiot like me do it? And, you know, I spoke to Bruce Rideout, who's a veterinary pathologist at San Diego Zoo. He really knows exotic diseases and such. And he said, Matt, I guarantee you, even an idiot like you could do it. And so I started calling up butchers in London and saying, hey, can I come and study your livers, please? Vicky, I went through 18 butchers with people sometimes being rather rude. In fairness, it was just before Christmas. So, it's a busy time for butchers. But I finally found Struan at Provenance Butcher in Notting Hill. And rather than hang up on me, he said, I'm intrigued. You want to do what?
I love it.
And so I left the office early, and my boss looked at me and said, where are you going? We have deadlines. And I said, I've got some Christmas shopping. And he said, you're lying. Where are you really going? And I said, okay, fine. I'm going to try to see if I can predict the future using animal livers in Notting Hill. And he said, that sounds fantastic. Can I come? So before I knew it, I'm down at this butcher in Notting Hill with my boss. And Stern had accrued all of these livers from pigs. And he said, here's a pile of livers. Some of these livers come from animals that were prancing around very merrily in West Yorkshire on grassy hills. And some of these animals were coming from battery farming in Netherlands. See if you can tell the difference. And it was really obvious. You could really tease out, this animal is coming, you know, this animal is very different from that animal. We were able to create two piles. And he said, okay, you've differentiated very well. But we'd actually got it totally wrong. Battery farmed animals have livers that look actually quite healthy because they're completely free of disease. They really don't get any exercise. They just eat and eat and eat. And so you get these really big, firm, bright livers. And animals that are running around in the field, they actually have it a little harder. It's probably a better life for them. But their livers look a little bit more yellow, a little more flaccid. And if you had a diseased animal, which we didn't in the butcher because you wouldn't ever see those in a modern butcher shop, it would look really horrendous. So I think our ancestors early on were onto something, and that over the years, their practice of whether the fields were going to be good by looking at what the gods said through the liver got altered into other things. And that's why we look at it, you know, at the Roman time and say, God, these guys are crazy. And so that's really what a lot of the book is about.
I love the fact that you did not, and I think one of your reviewers said this too, but you did not set out just to debunk these myths and these superpowers. You really took a look at what probably you would call the magical, because I read you, you quote, I'm going to read a quote here from you. I might even describe the experience of discovering the science behind our myths as magical.
You know, you're reading the very last sentence of the book. So yes, I became a science journalist because I love knowing how things work. I absolutely love learning. And as a paleontologist, I enjoyed the process of studying fossils and trying to tease out what a fossil could tell us about the ancient world. If you find five animal fossils in one site, what does that tell you about what the ecosystem once was? That's great, but it works very slowly when in the research world. You spend a year studying just five sets of bones, and then you write a paper about it.
Yeah.
As a science journalist, I had this opportunity to really jump in and explore content in such depth, and I was never out to debunk. That wasn't the point. The point was to explore. And sometimes I think our ancestors were onto things, and sometimes they weren't. Sometimes I couldn't find any evidence whatsoever that the myth that they came up with had a scientific basis. And when that was so, I said it. And I felt very strongly about that, because as a scientist by training, I wanted to be honest with my readers and not come away suggesting that our ancestors were always right or that our ancestors were always buffoons.
Right. There was many times an element of truth in there, and we know differently now than they knew then. We do need to take a quick break here, but I read in the book, you actually said in the book, in the intro, from the examples in the book, we see that magic can function a bit like a fossil. So when we come back, I'd like to ask you to explain that to us.
Sure.
And the book is called Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. My guest is Matt Kaplan, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Got a bad liver and a broken heart. Yeah, I drunk me a river since you told.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live, Vicky talks with one of America's leading word nerds to learn some of the new words added to this year's dictionary. We'll also check back with Sue Aikens, whose Life on the Frozen Tundra is featured in National Geographic's Life Below Zero. And can you say cheese? We'll talk cheddar with cheesemonger and author Gordon Edgar. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Made fresh each day for you. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is scientific journalist Matt Kaplan. His book is called Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. And Matt's put, gosh, an intensive amount of work into this as a scientist chasing myths around the world. How long did it take you to put this together, Matt?
A little over 2 years. But I was really lucky. The first year was hard. I mean, I was juggling my regular workload along with writing this on the side. And sometimes, you know, you have 4 or 5 articles in a single week that you have to really finish off, and then you get nothing done on the book. But last year, I was awarded this fellowship at MIT and at Harvard, and I really had a ton of time to just dig in and research a lot of this material and actually take time out to go and hunt myths physically,
right,
which was so rewarding.
What a gift, and what a gift to the reader, too, the finished product here. I said before the break that you wrote in the introduction, from the examples in the book, we see that magic can function a bit like a fossil. So explain that to us.
So if our ancestors went and created a story and just made it up, you have nothing other than their imaginations recorded. But we know from modern evidence that this is not how things work. And this is why actually superpowers is mentioned in the title of the book. It's not just a cheap gag at connecting to pop culture. If you think about the way in which stories are told, look at the 1960 Marvel comics that came out. If you think about Spider-Man, how did Spider-Man become Spider-Man, Vicky?
I don't honestly know, because I don't know anything about Spider-Man.
That's right. He got bit by a spider, but it was not just any spider, it was a radioactive spider. And then if you look at X-Men, X-Men are the children of the atom. They are the result of atomic radiation altering their DNA and making them mutants. If you look at The Incredible Hulk, Bruce Banner becomes The Incredible Hulk because he was exposed to gamma radiation. This all goes back to the 1960s, early 1960s, during the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when radiation was very much on everybody's mind. And what you have in all of these stories is a social catharsis, as it were, where people are going and they're putting a lot of what they're encountering in the real world into their fiction. And so we have it preserved there. And you could say, okay, but we still have Spider-Man. Yes. But if you look at the modern Spider-Man films, Spider-Man is now bit by a transgenic spider as opposed to a radioactive spider. The mechanism has changed because our concerns have changed. Our worries have changed. The things we focus on have changed. When you look back at the ancient myths of our ancestors, they really were not very different. You find bits and pieces of material where you can say, where did this come from? Did they just make this up, or were they trying to report or explore things that they were encountering in the natural world and putting it into their fictions?
Mm. Yeah, I remember reading that in the introduction when you were talking about how it, you know, because we often hear this question, does art imitate life or does life imitate art? And that kind of addressed that, I think, quite succinctly.
I think so.
Yeah. One other question that you had, and then I'd like to look at some of the science versus the magical, if we can. But you say that you had a long love of the magical yourself. And one of the questions you had when you first began writing or researching your book was, does knowing how something magical works make it into something other than magic?
Yeah, so I think... So that was a tremendous journey, and that is really the crux of the entire book.
Mm-hmm.
If you find out that our ancestors were really onto something when they were doing liver readings, for example, how does that change your perception of what they were doing? Do you view it as different? And is it now more interesting or less interesting? If you were to use the word magical, would you say it is more magical or less magical? And the critical question you would have to ask yourself is, if you were an avid hepatomancer visitor, so if you had your local liver reader and you were going to them regularly, would knowing that there was actually something biological behind having the liver reader tell you whether the fields that you're going to build your farm on were good or not, shape your perceptions of the process? And that is a question that at first seems so simple to answer, but that itself is an illusion. The closer you look and the more examples you look at, the more it varies.
Mm. I don't know if this tells us more about you than we need to know here, but I read that your personal favorite ritual was when people put the nails through the heart of chickens to curse someone.
Oh, God, it's just so horrible. I mean, seriously, that was one of my examples of something that, as far as I can tell, has absolutely no scientific basis whatsoever. If you didn't like somebody, you would take chicken bits and you would stuff them with the fingernails of your enemies or the hairs of your enemies, and then you would nail them to their door as a mechanism of casting a curse. I mean, how messed up is that? If I opened my door and I found something like that nailed up against it, it might actually have an effect because I'd be so disturbed. But that's something that I think doesn't have a basis in reality. But there are so many things that do. I mean, one of my personal favorites, you find that the Egyptians many years ago were painting their faces in the visage of their god Horus.
Mm.
And in 1902, George Bernadotte went out from the Louvre Museum and he found a bunch of these jars of makeup. They were so excited. And they started to analyze the makeup. And they found that the makeup, in spite of the fact that the Egyptians believed that when they painted their faces in the way of their god protected them from disease, they found rather high concentrations of lead compounds in the makeup. And they came to the conclusion, as rightly they should, that the Egyptians were painting their faces with poison. It was loaded with lead. They were what foolish people the Egyptians were. And it was just left for 100 years in the basement of the Louvre. Never mind that they had this long tradition of doing it for almost 1,000 years, it was dismissed as bunk. Then in 2010, Christian Amator at the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris collaborated with Philippe Walter at the Louvre, and Dr. Amator said, I have a hypothesis. I think the lead ions that are found in this makeup actually mimic a lot of the ions that are used by your body to set off the alarm system to get your immune cells to come to areas where they're being attacked. And I think the Egyptians were using this makeup to improve their immune system around their eyes. Now, that was a fascinating hypothesis because the god Horus regularly kept having his eye stabbed or severed by the evil god Set, and his eye always regenerated. So Dr. Amator looked at the medication, the makeup, and found that when he tested it on the cells that would surround the eye, it in fact releases a chemical compound called nitric oxide, which summons immune cells to the area. And you have to ask yourself, why would that be useful to you? He also found, by the way, that the lead ions were not in high enough concentrations to be toxic, which was pivotal. Well, the hypothesis that they had was, if you have to wash your face with water from the Nile every day, which is loaded with bacteria, and you don't have any modern medicine, that actually circling your eye with this compound that summoned immune cells to be aggregating in that zone would prevent you from developing really nasty diseases.
Yeah.
And this is something that we can really learn from, because today we're having so much trouble with antibiotics. You go and kill the bacteria directly and they evolve very quickly to respond to that, and you get antibiotic resistant bacteria. Using medications and drugs like what the Egyptians used to summon immune cells to the area just so your immune system can be more effective is a wonderful alternative tactic. So we have a lot to learn from these folks as well.
We do.
It's just amused that they're not crazy.
We do. There's an element of truth in almost everything you talk about here, you know, if we can put a spin on it. You shared a story of talking of healing, of taking your mother to Bath in Bristol, around Bristol area.
Sure. No, it's around Bath, not Bristol.
Yes, Bath. Isn't it down Bristol Way?
No, you would take the train up from London to Bath Spa. It's actually in the town of Bath.
Yeah, okay. It's been a while since I've been there. For some reason, I thought it was down by Bristol. But, okay, share that story with us, if you would, because it was kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. That was delightfully uncomfortable. So, right. I'm an American who's been living in the UK for an extraordinarily long period of time. And you never go into the tourist stuff. When you're working there, you think, it's a tourist trap, I'm not going. But there's so much literature associated with Bath having been a place of healing. And I thought, okay, right, I should go and check it out. And you look at the chemistry of the water at Bath, there's nothing special about it. There have been tons of surveys on the water itself, because our ancestors believed that if they came to this site at Bath, which was, you know, used by the Romans extensively and long before them by others, that if they bathed in the waters, if they drank the water, that they would be healed. And there's nothing chemically relevant. But I thought, okay, right, no, I'll go try this out. And they actually have a spa at the site where you can engage in all of these ancient spa rituals, and some of them were really rather disgusting. I remember sitting there, because my mother's an art historian, she wanted to tag along. I'm sitting in this musty barn with steam coming out of hay, and she looked at me and said, "Why are we doing this?" And I said, "It's research for the book, Mom. Yeah, it'll be fine." And then afterwards, I went down to the spa itself, and you know, it's sort of lukewarm. It's not really hot,
right?
And there are all these teenagers who are plunging their tongues into each other's mouths,
right.
And it's like, oh God, this is horrendous. But you have to start to think about things from an ancient perspective. Okay, fine. So the water doesn't have any chemical basis to it. But in a day and age when those spas were considered sacred, the idea of being able to get into a warm bath was all but impossible. You couldn't find warmth anywhere. And we know from modern research, which we talk about a lot, which I talk about a lot in the book, if you are chronically cold, even just a little bit cold, that reduces your immune system by a lot, because your body is spending all of its energy trying to keep you warm.
Yes.
So if you go to a place and you are ill where you don't have to manage your thermoregulation, where you don't have to stay warm, your body is kept warm by the waters and the facility where they have steam, then you can allow your immune system to get on with its work because you can allocate more resources to it. So it makes sense that our ancestors came to believe that these hot spring sites, because Bath wasn't alone, were associated with healing, because we also know that with sinus infections and arthritis and a whole host of other diseases, hot, wet conditions are really conducive to healing. So it's not total nonsense that they went and came up with these ideas.
Right.
But I will tell you, it was weird going there with my mom.
Well, you share a story in there of the mice who were kept today at fairly low temperatures to keep them cool, because then they don't need to go to the bathroom as much, and the lab researchers don't have to clean it up as much.
You're talking about Elizabeth Rapaski's work. Oh my God, that was crazy.
It fascinated me.
We have so much work that's done on mice. And now mice like really warm temperatures. That they don't like the sorts of temperatures that we are used to. They prefer warmer temperatures. But in laboratories, we keep them at colder temperatures so they don't pee as often, so that the lab staff don't have to change them as often. And we run tons and tons and tons of medical studies on these mice. And those medical studies are all very likely flawed, because Elizabeth Rapaski was able to demonstrate that mice kept at these temperatures versus much warmer temperatures have sabotaged immune systems.
Right.
So we know that having cool temperatures, and the same is true for us, we know that if we are kept chilled, we just don't heal as rapidly, and we have lots of problems that follow. So it's no wonder that our ancestors sought out places of geothermal warmth and then called them magical.
Well, we're right at the end of our segment. Very quickly, do you have a final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners? This is a really fascinating read. And I have to say, Matt, you did a fantastic job balancing that science and myth and modern day information, too. I mean, it just really came together well.
Well, thank you very, very much, Vicky. If I had to say anything, it would be, we so often differentiate between mythology and science as complete opposites, not related. And I think that when you look at mythology, mythology is often used to explain things that people can't understand. And science is also used to explain things that we can't understand. They use very different methods, but at their core, they're both often used to explain the unexplainable. And in that way, they're actually much more closely related than many people give them credit for.
Well, I thank you for being with us today, Matt. Fascinating book, and enjoyed talking with you. And I wish you much success.
Thank you so much, Vicky. You have a great day.
My guest again, Matt Kaplan, a science correspondent with The Economist, and his book, Science of the Magical, from the Holy Grail to love potions to superpowers. And please stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
They're justified and they're ancient, and they like to roam the land.
Just roll it from the top.
They're justified and they're ancient. I hope you understand.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing. Writing it, another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Designing Health, makers of Missing Link, we cover the world of animals. This week, December 13th, it's a Best Sunday with Dr. Nels Rasmussen, and we'll have open phone lines. Dr. Nels can help with emotional, behavioral, or physical problems. He can test for allergies, drug, or supplement compatibility and dosages for you or your animal friends. Call us for a free remote session. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You must have thrown 1,000 pitches teaching him to hit a home run. Spent countless Saturdays running routes so he could learn to hit an open receiver. Endless afternoons teaching him how to hit the three-pointer. But how much time have you spent teaching him what not to hit? Teaching boys that all violence against women is wrong is one of the most important things a man can do. Learn how to start the conversation at teachearly.org. Brought to you by Futures Without Violence and the Ad Council.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Good news, Belgium. We're streamed worldwide at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my second guest shares an incredible story. I said at the top of the hour, it's one of those stories where you think, oh, that can't possibly be true, but it is. The author of 438 Day joins me from Chile. He's sharing the story of Captain Salvador Alvarenga. Outside Magazine calls the book the best survival book in a decade, and that book is called 438 Days, an extraordinary true story of survival at sea. My guest is Jonathan Franklin, an investigative journalist. He's reported for the New York Times, Boston Globe, and The Guardian. And he also works with the team at Retro Report, producing documentaries broadcast by the New York Times. And he's also the author of 33 Men, which I believe is coming out or came out in a movie last month, 33 Men. Jonathan Franklin, welcome.
Thank you, Vicky.
Well, glad to have you here. We're going to test out the sound here just to give everyone fair warning. We might have to cut to break early and call you back on a different number here, but we sound okay right now. So, So you're based basically between Manhattan and Chile?
Correct. Yep, I spend most of the time in Chile and a few months a year up in Manhattan, where it's a different sort of action.
Right, and I saw you got 7 daughters. You got 8 women there keeping you in line.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I like to write about survivors.
Well, I read that you tend to live off the grid, especially when he's writing, and then I saw you had 7 daughters, and I was like, well, that probably plays into it too. Although I know you love them dearly.
That's fun.
So one good thing about being a writer, you can get to escape that way sometimes. So
I do it.
This book is it's one of those you just can't put down. You say that when you heard the story of a guy who said he'd floated for 7,000 miles across the Pacific Ocean in an open boat, your reaction was a bit like my reaction, was, yeah, right. But then curiosity got the better of you. So where were you when you heard about the story, and what triggered your curiosity?
I was here in Santiago, Chile, and it was a very big story for about a day or two in 2014, and I just knew there was something there, and I even thought that if it was a fake, it was a great story, because, you know, something definitely happened. A small fishing boat did make it from Mexico halfway around the Pacific. This gentleman, who was a pretty simple fisherman, did either washed up or helicoptered or droned in something, but, you know, even if it wasn't true, it was a great story. But the more I started to dig into it, the more I found that there had been a large search and rescue operation for the gentleman. This is a guy who doesn't know how to read or write. He's a pretty simple guy. You know, he shows up on the other side of the world with no lawyer, no press team, no understanding at all of what's happening. And his first demand is that nobody interview him and they'd be left alone. And it didn't sound like the attitude of a scammer.
And so how difficult was it to validate the journey that he was on? Because he for the most of that journey, he was alone.
It was very difficult. But what I did is he had no clock, Vicky. He had no way of telling time. So he would say things like, oh, I saw a whale in the 7th month, or, you know, at month 10, I saw some lights to the north. So he would have these very specific memories lined up with specific times, and I would go back to experts and say, okay, you know, would a whale be in this part of the ocean? Would you be able to find sea turtles in this other part? You know, what island might he have seen when he says he saw the light? And every little thing checked out, and his descriptions of life out at sea were just so detailed, and every time I ran those by scientists and experts on global currents or sea turtle experts or survival psychologists, it's always lined up to a T. And then the University of Hawaii and the U.S. Coast Guard ran some simulations on where a boat would end up if it drifted off Mexico, and the computer model brings it right to the island.
Right, right. We're having a little trouble hearing you, Jonathan, so I'm going to go to break, and we will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest is Jonathan Franklin, his book, 430 Days. And he's in Santiago, Chile, so we're going to call him back a different way. We'll be right back.
The lonely sea. The lonely sea. It never stops.
You must have thrown 1,000 pitches teaching him to hit a home run. Spent countless Saturdays running routes so he could learn to hit an open receiver. Endless afternoons teaching him how to hit the three-pointer. But how much time have you spent teaching him what not to hit? Teaching boys that all violence against women is wrong is one of the most important things a man can do. Learn how to start the conversation at teachearly.org. Brought to you by Futures Without Violence and the Ad Council.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Next week on Conversations Live, Vicky talks with one of America's leading word nerds to learn some of the new words added to this year's dictionary. We'll also check back with Sue Aikens, whose Life on the Frozen Tundra is featured in National Geographic's Life Below Zero. And Can You Say Cheese? We'll talk cheddar with cheesemonger and author Gordon Edgar. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch podcasts at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to brighten your day.
Spread the word. Your favorite shows are on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is journalist Jonathan Franklin. His book, 438 Days, An Extraordinary True Story of Survival at Sea. And this really is an extraordinary story. And it's beautifully written, too, Jonathan. It just pulled me straight through. I wanted to know what was going to happen next and how he coped with this and how he coped with that. But before we went to break, you were talking about some of the experts, many, many, many experts you talked with, to try and validate as much of this story as you could.
Yeah, I'm no expert on ocean currents or ecosystems or the behavior of whales or sea turtles. So what I would do is I would take the interviews from Alvarenga, and there must have been, I had 300 pages or so of interviews, and I would run it by experts. If Alvarenga said that he found turtles near the coast and the turtles were filled with eggs in November, I would run that by the sea turtle experts, and they would say, yes, you would find turtles near the coast at this time, and yes, they would have eggs. And every time I checked out his pretty specific details, even the kinds of clouds, the kinds of storms, the different ecosystems he passed through, it all lined up. And what I found especially convincing was the very extensive search and rescue effort by the Mexican Coast Guard. There was SOS calls as he was about to sink. They looked for him in a small plane. They looked for him in boats. Unfortunately, in Mexico, they only look for about 3 days before giving up. But this is not a guy who just disappeared and then all of a sudden popped up in the Marshall Islands.
Right, right. So I guess the first question I had, and a couple of other people that I'd recommended your book to, was, well, how did he survive? So where did he get his water from? What did he do for food?
Well, what's really either miraculous or pretty sad is that one of the keys to his survival is just the sheer amount of trash in the ocean. Very early on, he started grabbing anything that looked interesting or useful. He found floating bags of garbage that sometimes had carrots rotting in the bottom that he could eat. He found many plastic water bottles empty, but they were floating. So he could, he had, I think by the end, 73 plastic water bottles that he found. He found a big blue barrel, like a 55-gallon oil drum, but clean. So he starts to collect the garbage from the ocean and kind of fashion this kind of survival ecosystem bit by bit.
And he was actually very creative, because, at one point that it did not rain. He'd got very little water left. He had to ration it out. He actually took to getting some of the fish bones that he'd caught and eaten, and actually grinding up the fish bone to give him some calcium nutrient.
Yeah, I'd say it was kind of like, and I think then he put either little drip drops of water. It was like his oatmeal kind of, fish meal with water.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a very good hunter. He was extremely good at catching sharks. He would catch them with his bare hands, which sounds almost impossible until you start hanging around the shark fishermen of Mexico and you see what they can do.
Right.
And when he caught the sharks, he would eat their livers, which is, in a shark, about a third to a quarter of the body weight. And shark liver is just incredibly good for you. It's used as a home remedy in Scandinavia and Japan and different parts of the world. So without knowing it, he was eating some of the most nutritious things in the sea, the turtle blood. He was drinking massive amounts of turtle blood early on, the turtle eggs, the turtle meat. He said he would even scrape out the skull and get out all the pieces. So he was quite a hunter, and he was on one of the rainiest stretches of the planet. So it was raining often 2 or 3 times a week.
Yeah, which was lucky for him. 14 months at sea. That's longer than anybody in history, as far as we know. So one of the things that you wonder, because he did leave Mexico, the shore of Mexico, he left with a shipmate. Now, that shipmate did die on that journey. And I believe, as in the book you say, he sat with his dead shipmate for, I think it was 6 days before he had the will to throw him overboard, and then he passed out. So, I mean, he was in such a really bad way himself. He did have suicidal thoughts, but what kept him going? What do you think there was that intrinsic thing to Salvador that kept him going?
Well, I think one of the things, which is not the most obvious, but he has an incredible sense of humor. You know, very early on in this, he nicknamed his boat the Titanic. I mean, we're talking a tiny little boat that's the size of it's only about a pickup and a half, maybe a pickup truck and a half long, like 24 feet long. And he called it the Titanic. And he had this kind of gallows humor that allowed him to eat raw birds. But he imagined that he was having ceviche or fresh chicken, and he would drip little bits of water on it and imagine it was some sort of cilantro sauce. And so he started to basically hypnotize himself, and he came close to killing himself several times. He just said he just couldn't take the solitude, and so he would pour the turtle blood into the water and throw fish guts until the sharks were just in a mad frenzy. And then his plan was to jump in and get eaten by the sharks. And you have to be in really bad sorts if you consider that as like your best option.
I would say so. So he really created this alternate reality, didn't he? He would sometimes envision that he was having dinner with friends and stuff too.
Yeah, this had begun as a way to hypnotize or trick his mate, who was not at all as experienced out at sea and was constantly afraid and vomiting. And he tried to convince his mate that everything was going to be okay by saying, "Hey, I see a tortilla store. Wait a second." And he would pace the length of the boat and pretend that the tortilla store was closed, and he would come back to his mate and say, "Oh, bad luck, they're closed for lunch." And his mate, who was kind of hallucinating, dying of hunger at that point, would say, "Oh, great, I'll wait." And he could buy himself a little peace and quiet. And eventually his friend did starve to death because he was unable and unwilling to eat this really nasty diet that they were forced upon.
Right.
But Alvarenga then uses these same tools that he had invented to save his buddy. He takes those same tools and begins to use them on himself. And I think a lot of his ability to survive is this ability to find meaning all the time. He would imagine talking to his girlfriends, playing football. And finally, he had been a very bad father, or pretty much an AWOL father. He had abandoned his young daughter when she was less than a year old. And out there at sea, he had more than enough time to reflect on what kind of person he was, what kind of legacy he might leave, and he was pretty embarrassed and shamed.
Mm.
This is a man who loves children. One of the things that came up in my research was that he was always doting on the little kids in town, you know, bringing them, you know, bringing the little boys fish, bringing the little girls candies, and joking around. He had worked for years as a clown at children's birthday parties when he was a teenager. So he was a very good-natured and funny guy, but with his own daughter, he had been a zero. So he really wanted the chance to see if he could reinvent himself.
Yeah, that's an awesome story. Now, when he did finally reach land, are they back at home after a year, they had like small funeral services for him, so they could collect the death benefits then. His father never told his mother that Salvador Alvarenga was lost and presumed dead.
Yeah, well, I know his mother, and she has pretty bad diabetes, and the idea was that keeping her calm was more important than giving her the truth. So to the mother, they told nothing. But then the Alvarenga's girlfriend and the mother to his daughter came up with a kind of crazy story. She told the daughter that a shark had eaten her dad, and that was that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the daughter was... But the daughter never totally believed it, she told me. She thought that she was clever enough not to totally believe that. And their parents were fighting a bit. But it was a little drastic to say, you know, "Sorry, Dad got eaten by a shark. You know, go on to school, honey," you know.
Yeah. Well, we've done shows before on pet therapy. And here's a testament to pet therapy, because one of those birds that he caught to eat, he actually kept as a pet, Pancho. although he did come close to being eaten at one point when birds were in scarce supply.
Yes, indeed.
So eventually he washes up, and really can't believe his eyes that he's actually washed up somewhere, doesn't know where, of course, and appears like a madman to somebody who hears him screaming. Tell us about that.
Well, when he washes ashore, he can't really walk. His leg muscles have all atrophied. He's got one pretty decent sized knife and a huge beard, and he looks like Tom Hanks, like maybe took acid.
Fast away, right?
Or maybe like Tom Hanks on acid, because he's totally out of it. I mean, he's afraid of people. He's pretty convinced that whoever's there is probably a cannibal. He's already had to, like, he hasn't seen a live human being in over a year. The last human being he saw was a corpse for a week. So he is really, really just frazzled and out of it. And he's kind of crawling along the beach, stumbling along, pretty much naked, all hairy, with his big knife. And he's screaming at the top of his lungs. And then he hears a rooster. And when he hears a rooster, he knows he's saved. And, or at least that there's human settlement. And he sees a couple who's, I mean, it sounds, you can't make this stuff up. The couple's job is to collect coconuts on this little paradise, you know, paradise island. And they've been collecting their coconuts, and they hear screaming, and they see what looks like an animal crawling, stumbling along the beach. And as they get closer, they realize it's a man, and he has a big knife. And so the husband says to the wife, "Let's go hide in the house." And the wife says, wait, this guy looks like he needs help. And they have this kind of standoff where the couple finally convinces Alvarenga to dump his knife. And then,
because they couldn't understand each other, could they? He's originally from, was it El Salvador? I forget where he was originally from.
Yeah, exactly. So he's screaming in a, and it's a slang Spanish that's hard to understand anyway. And they're speaking local Marshallese dialect. And, you know, at first they're not even sure if they're the same species, not to mention, you know, the same, same language. But then he throws his knife in the water and just drops to his knees and begins to pray. And when the woman on the island sees that, she feels a real tenderness and decides to, she says to her husband, "Go give him a hug like those white people do."
But he didn't like it. He didn't want them to touch him. He didn't want to even make eye contact, did he?
No. He said she wanted to touch my hair, but I wasn't ready for that.
Well, eventually when he gets back, you know, I've talked with a lot of adventurers and explorers and photographers who go to the end of the earth and scientists who do the same thing. And they always say how difficult it is to re-enter back into what we call normal life. And this must have been excruciatingly difficult for him. And you document some of that in the book. One thing that struck me was how angry he was with his friends for not continuing to look for him. He was upset that they drank there and they sat there and drank coffee and smoked pot and thought about him. And he said, "You should have been looking for me."
Exactly. He thought they hadn't really looked because he misunderstood really the ferociousness of the storm. He has like this wild, you know, self-confidence where he'll go out in a storm to look for people. And so he assumes that everybody will go out in a storm and look for you. But this was a really rough storm. And, his friends had actually had a funeral service for him, and as part of the funeral service, the tradition was to drink coffee. And he just kept saying to them, "I can't believe you coffeed me. You coffeed me, and you were smoking pot. You should have been looking for me." And he didn't believe they looked for him until they actually showed up the paperwork. And then he kind of understood. But he, you know, and the backstory there is that the man in charge of the rescue, that Alvarenga had been sleeping with the guy's wife. So he kind of doubted that this man might be actually looking for him because of what happened. So there was a love triangle that
he was
also
worried about karma there.
or where the loyalties were. So there was lots of cross currents, so to speak. But he really liked going back to see his friends, you know, and he was accepted back in that world. And they wanted him to go back fishing. And I mean, he has so much confidence. He says, "Okay, I'll go back fishing, but only if I can see shore, because that's 18 miles. Right. So then if my boat sinks, I can swim to shore. And I was like, I just think, you know, nobody can swim 18 miles, but he's convinced that as long as he can see shore, he'll be able to, maybe he can swim 18 miles, but I don't know. But, you know, that's his kind of mentality is, you know, only 18 miles offshore, I'll just swim back.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're right at the end of our segment. It's a great book, great story, really well written. I know that you write in the book that you saw a huge difference in him during the year you were interviewing him. And I think listeners are just going to have to buy the book if they want to find out, because we are, unfortunately, right at the end of our show. Final thought, very quickly, you'd like to leave with our listeners.
Well, I think the most important thing is when I asked Alvarenga, why do you want to do this book? He said, look, people are always committing suicide and thinking about suicide because of their mental stress and their problems in their head. He said, I had all those problems in my head, plus all these physical problems like food, thirst.
Right, right.
He said, you know, if I can make it, you can make it. So he was really interested in having this story shared with people who are fighting either depression or, you know, loneliness. And his motivations, I thought, were very, very unique, and that he wasn't thinking about himself. He was thinking how, you know, his tragedy might be able to help others.
Well, Jonathan Franklin, I really appreciate you being with us today. The book is called 438 Days, An Extraordinary True Story of Survival at Sea. And you can find out more about it at Twitter, at Franklin Blog. And what's your website, very quickly?
JonathanFranklin.com.
Thank you.
Best of all, go to your local library and get a copy.
There you go. Super. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for being with us. And we have to run. Thanks for being with us. We will see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.